Hello, hello, and welcome to Textures for Good podcast. It's a podcast dedicated to highlighting the stories of women leaders who are using technology to tackle some of the biggest challenges facing our planet today. Through this podcast, our goal is to showcase the terrific work and inspire other women to follow in their footsteps. My name is Saurabh, and I will be your host for this journey. So, let us begin. Hi, Farah. Welcome to Tech Heroes for Good podcast. How are you doing today?
Hi, Saurabh. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm really excited to be here today.
Oh, same here. I'm more excited than you are, because I have never had any guest on this podcast who's from the MENA region, so I'm super excited to know about the new startup ecosystem that we'll be talking about. So let's start with your introduction. That I know that you are, you're from Egypt, and apart from that, that's the only thing that we know. So please give a little brief about what do you do and where you're based out of.
Sure. So I'm based out of Cairo, Egypt. I've lived here all my life. I just studied abroad in the UK for a few years for my undergrad and my master's. But other than that, I've been living here, and really, it's a very dynamic country to live in, where you get exposed to a lot of issues, and you know, it's full of opportunity for startups and for other corporates just to make advancements in general. So I grew up here. I studied my undergrad was in Durham University, where I did geography, geography, business, and economics, and then started working in Endeavor Egypt. That was around 2012, and at the time, entrepreneurship was really not a very common term in Egypt. So Endeavor, which is a nonprofit organization headquartered in New York, when we come to introduce it in Egypt, you know, people wouldn't really understand what entrepreneurship was, even though there were amazing entrepreneurs, but they didn't classify themselves as that. So we worked for at Endeavor for around 5 years, and it was my role was to grow and scale some of Egypt's best entrepreneurs. And so really exposed me to a variety of industries and really inspirational people. I then left Endeavor and joined Procter & Gamble, where I was heading the strategic communications for the Near East region. So that included Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, Syria, and Iraq. And at the same time, I was pursuing my MBA at the London School of Economics. I left P&G 2018 to start Fresh Source with my brother, Omar.
Oh, that's some impressive profile you got out there. So you're from LSE and you have worked in FMCG sector, and you got exposed to entrepreneurship while working for the startup. So that's wonderful. And I believe that, you know, you're the CEO of your company is Omar, and who's not only working as the CEO of the startup, but also he's your brother and also massive support. Right. So that's wonderful. I mean, we generally don't get to see that, you know, that two siblings are working together on a project. And so my question to you is, how did you guys come together, leaving your well-paying jobs? And you mentioned that he was in London, I believe. And so I'm pretty sure that, you know, your family would have completely
lost it.
Exactly. I didn't want to say that. But yeah, they would have just completely lost it. And so what was the reaction from the family and your friends?
Yes, so I have to give you some background. So my father is an entrepreneur himself. He started his business in the 80s in agriculture and cold chain logistics. And they're actually one of the biggest facilities in the region. He understands the sector really well. And he knows how rough it is to be an entrepreneur. But, you know, it's his life. He really believes in it. My mom, on the other hand, is really, you know, she prefers to have something that is more stable, you know, like most parents. And something to just secure your life. And at the time, I was in P&G exactly, and Omar was in Goldman Sachs in London, and he was doing really well. And so when we came up with the idea of Fresh Source, and we decided to, you know, throw everything else and start it, our dad was quite supportive, but our mom was really worried, you know, which is her right. You know, it is a very risky thing to do. And she was just worried for our future, et cetera. So there was a lot of tears and pain and everything else. But at the end, you know, we were stubborn, and we decided that we're going to go for it. That's a
Yeah, I guess moms all across the world, they are just the same, no? They want the best future for their kids, and yeah, they want us to take the safest path possible. But then I'm so glad that, you know, that your father worked as an entrepreneur, and then he knew the ecosystem over there, how the cold storage facility work, and then, you know, he had some exposure in the agriculture sector, right? And I think that would have been a massive support from all getting all this this knowledge and legacy. I think that would have worked really well for you, right?
So 100%. So my background isn't agriculture and all, but it's finance, even though he does have experience in distribution logistics. But without the family business, you know, we would have just had faced a lot more obstacles, a lot more challenges. So it would have taken us a lot longer to get to where we want. So it was kind of like, you know, a faster route to where we wanted to go.
No, 100%. I absolutely agree that, you know, if you have already had some sort of experience in the family, and then might as well build upon that rather than just reinventing the wheel, right? So, okay, let's get into the details of FreshSource. So you've mentioned in one of the interviews that you're addressing two major issues. First is food waste, and second is exploitation of small farmers, right? So could you please tell us that what is the solution that FreshSource is offering that addresses sustainability?
Sure. So what we do is we're a B2B agri supply chain platform. So we partner with a wide range of producers. So those can be farms, those can be other types of producers, regardless of the size. And we work with them to improve their output. And we actually connect or we handle the complete value chain process and supply businesses. So the businesses we work with are restaurants, hotels, online retailers, small shops. And so we're really focused on the value chain as a whole and how to make this value chain as efficient as possible. So we use state-of-the-art equipment, top methods of storage and transportation, and that's what enables us to have a food loss rate of 5% compared to the national average, that's from anywhere from 30 to 45%.
Oh, great. So, I mean, that way you're addressing two problems at the same time. And you mentioned that, you know, your business model is B2B, but I believe you're also trying to get into the B2C segment with one of your recent partners, right?
So what we do is we partnered with a lot of the online groceries where they, you know, have their own grocery, online grocery. So we work with them to provide them with a convenient and reliable service where we do their deliveries daily to their centers, and then they handle the orders and the shipping, et cetera, from consumers. So we consider it still a business that we're selling to. But of course, you know, the packaging has to appeal more to a consumer than to a business, etc. So these are the changes that we were able to do.
Absolutely. I think you also always have to diversify your reach, right? Great. And I believe that you were selected for Google for Startups, right? And you received some incubation support in Berlin. So how was your experience?
Yeah. So those are very exciting. So we were part of the WMENA accelerator, which highlights women entrepreneurs in the MENA region. And that was the first accelerator we were ever part of. So they really helped us, you know, with our business model, what our strategy is going to be. And of course, there was a lot of exposure. We went to Berlin and Dubai, and we got to meet actually companies that are similar to us that work also in agriculture. And other entrepreneurs as well. So that was really impactful in that sense in the beginning at the stage that we were in. Last year, mid of last year, we got selected into the Google Startup Accelerator. That was just also really amazing because you get to have a network of Google experts to help you on everything with the business. So we were really focusing on our technology and improving and enhancing our technology. And now we have a team of experts, you know, guiding us on what are the main things that we need to watch out for and focus on. And so that's completely like that's invaluable.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that, you know, while going through these stages of incubation and acceleration, you receive so much value, right? Not just from the accelerator or the incubator itself, but also the massive value that you derive from the networking, right? Because you don't know who you might get in touch with who can just have such a massive value add, right? So great. And I just want to understand, because you have been a part of, you've been invited to Berlin, and overall your experience was amazing. But I want to talk a little bit about Egyptian startup ecosystem, right? Because I was going through one report from Startup Genome, and it mentioned that Egypt is, I mean, there's a lot happening in the MENA region, right? There's great deal of significant transformation in the MENA region. So let's talk about, I think, two most sub-segment strength that this particular ecosystem has is fintech and logistics and transport, right? Recently, I believe Sequoia Capital had their first venture in MENA region, and I believe it was for around $5 million for Telda. There was some fintech, right? So what I want to understand from you, how is the overall structure of Egyptian startup ecosystem, and what's good and what can be improved according to you?
Sure. So definitely there has been a significant rise in investments and just in you know, recognition of Egyptian startups. When we first started our company, the ecosystem wasn't like this. It wasn't this developed. Now, most of the top funded African startups are actually based in Egypt. It received, I think it was the third top country in the MENA region to receive investment. It really shows you that investors are starting to think of Egypt as a hub for innovation and entrepreneurship rather than the dangerous and unsafe, you know, country that it was considered previously. So what we saw during the Egyptian revolution was that a lot of companies were actually pulling out their funds. So a lot of the big corporations and a lot of investors, not just in startups, but in general, were just deciding to stay away from Egypt. And, you know, that was understood at the time because people were worried, how are we going to get our money out? There was also the foreign exchange crunch that a lot of people weren't able to export their dollars out of the country for their own use, etc. So there were issues at the time that caused the economy itself to really get reduced. And now, today, as we speak, you know, we're really booming. There are millions and millions and millions of dollars that are being injected. Even small startups that are still at the pre-seed stage, at the pre-revenue stage. So this really shows you that investor appetite and confidence is growing in Egypt. And when you see big names such as Sequoia start opening in the region, and Shuru, one of the big names, 40X as well, that they're starting to really ramp up their investments in Egypt, is just a testament to show that Egyptians, you know, are on the rise. Like I said, we're a country that is, we're still a developing country, obviously, and with that comes huge opportunity to make a lot of advancements and make a lot of impact in different industries. And we're also 100 million people. So, you know, it's an amazing population to address. We're mostly youth. And so we're tech savvy. Really, I think it's an ideal platform for disrupting traditional markets, for introducing new technologies. And that's why I think this hype is happening, and hopefully it will continue to do so.
100%. I hope the same for Egypt and the whole MENA region. And you were talking about the population, right? So I believe Egypt has quite a young population who are very tech savvy and entering the workforce, right? So I believe there are many universities which are constant source of workforce, right? So, and I also saw that Egypt ranks quite high when it comes to hiring talent at a much more economical rates. So I think that's also one of the reasons why so many VCs and there's so much funds flowing in the ecosystem, right? So now I want to talk about a little bit about the, because I read it somewhere that Egyptian agriculture exports in like last year topped around 5.6 million tons for the first time ever. And so what do you think is driving this growth? Is it agricultural? Is it investment in the agriculture sector, or do you think it's a combined effort of digital innovations in the sector, or what do you think?
So definitely, I think there's an increase in innovation in agriculture that, you know, increases the output across the field. There's also as we as Egyptians improve our agriculture practices, we're able to compete better globally. We still have cheap labor. We still have a cheap, lower price compared to other, you know, items that are grown in Europe, etc. But our quality can compete with these items. So that's when you see the increase in the Egyptian exports. So that's one. Another thing is that there were issues before where, you know, there were certain items that were not up to par, and that caused some friction with other countries that export import from us. And so once we're able to prove ourselves that we have a certain quality of product, this brought these political relationships back. So, for instance, we started exporting again to Saudi Arabia, even though that had some issues previously, but that was overcome. So these are all steps in the ladder to really make us one of the top exporters in agriculture products.
So what I want to understand from you now is that since Egypt is doing so much and you guys are like, you know, the young entrepreneurs are just riding this wave of innovation all across, what according to you should be support from the government side? Because I know there's lots happening from the government side. So is the government supportive of the towards the ecosystem, or is it only the private funds that are flowing in the ecosystem?
So in the beginning, the government, I think, didn't really consider startups to have or expect them to have such a huge impact or be a key player in the Egyptian economy. But I think we can see from Swivel, you know, that's an Egyptian company, even though it's based in the UAE, it's completely Egyptian. The founders and everything out here, and other companies that are really making changes globally have emerged from Egypt. And so the change that I have seen in the past few years are a lot more government support, a lot of government programs that are taking place from the Ministry of Investment, from the Ministry of Agriculture in our case. But the Ministry of Investment, for instance, has it deploys funds to different to a couple of VCs for them to, you know, start investing in entrepreneurs. There's also the annual World Youth Summit that occurs every year in Sharm el-Sheikh that has, you know, the our president there. And that is focused mostly on youth entrepreneurship startups. So I really do see how it's starting to boom. Also, there are now banking services for startups. So there are specific loans that startups, even if they're losing, can start to apply for. And these are all ways of facilitating the startup environment for us in Egypt.
100%. I think it's really essential for, I don't believe that any ecosystem can thrive without the government support, right? Although there can be some elements of bureaucracy as well as, you know, the process is a little slower, but then I think government support is quite essential for any ecosystem growth. Great. So now I want to switch over to agri-tech and sustainability, right? So I'm going to, so I recently read a report from Sifted. Okay, it says that by around 2050, our food system will need to provide for an estimate of 9.7 billion people, right? So, and also climate change poses a massive threat for our food security. Agriculture industry needs to adapt and bring in more innovation, right? So what are the few challenges that needs to be addressed to solve this issue?
Yeah, so just to give you some feedback, some overview on agriculture. So it is one of the leading sectors in Egypt, and it contributes around 11% of the country's GDP and makes up 28% of all jobs in the country. So, of course, it has huge potential to grow even more. And it hasn't been disrupted yet. And by disrupted, I mean hasn't been completely transformed through technology. When you compare it to the logistics sector, there are now over 20 startups that address or that are building advanced platforms to optimize the logistics industry. And so agriculture is a bit lagging in this area in Egypt. If you compare it to India, if you compare it to Pakistan, there are also really agriculturally dominant countries. They have a lot of startups in this space that are building tech platforms to facilitate the movement of goods, to optimize the value chain, and to also increase the agriculture output. And actually, when we came to Start Fresh Source, we connected with a lot of these companies. So we spoke to startups in India, we spoke to startups in Kenya and Ghana, and that's what gave us, you know, a boost to start to understand what's the best way to start building our own platform.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned the Indian scenario, that you know what's happening in India, because I know we have a massive population of around 1.3 billion people. And then, of course, food security, as we see it, we have to feed billions of people. And I think across 70%, if I'm not wrong, 70% of the population just relies on agriculture, and it's so inconsistent in terms of the reliability of agriculture sector on on monsoon, on climate, and climate change is having a massive impact on our food security also, right? And this is what my next question is, that there is a absolute lack of sustainability in our current food system, and that is a major issue. Of course, everyone understands that. Plus, that we have a problem for heating planet and food loss, and waste account to close to, like, I believe, quarter of the global greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, the access to good food, or in terms of like nutrition and healthy food in communities, still dependent on the socioeconomic background, right? Basically, what I'm trying to say is that if you belong to a better socioeconomic, if you have a better socioeconomic background, you have better access to nutrition and food. So how do you think that this solution or the solution that you are providing through Fresh Source will be able to sort of add value to this?
Sure. So yeah,
because I believe I just want to mention that you've mentioned that you are providing access to fresher food because you are removing the middlemen. And then by doing that, you're shortening the value chain, and then you're reaching directly from farm to the consumer, right? And that also has impact on the freshness element of the food. So yeah, how are you able to achieve that?
Yeah, so in Egypt, around it's anywhere from 30% to 45% of food is lost. And food loss is very different than food waste. So food loss is anything that happens before the item reaches the store. Once you as a consumer store and purchase it, that starts the food waste journey. So what happens at your home, that's considered food waste. Before that, it's food loss. So when you hear a shocking statistic like 45% of food is lost, that means that when you go into the store, you're seeing nearly half of what you can be seeing. And accordingly, who's paying for this? Who's paying for this difference? You as a consumer, and the producer, the farmer, regardless of what size farm they are, they're still, incurring this loss. And this loss comes from a number of reasons. It comes from post-harvesting. So, harvesting at the wrong time, at spraying the wrong fertilizers and pesticides at incorrect times. So that means that the output per acre is not as much as it could be if you are following good agriculture practices. Following that, the storage and the transportation. So when there are 3 to 5 intermediaries between the producer and the store, that means that there's a lot of chances for items to get lost, to get rotten, storing in wrong temperatures, using inadequate packaging. So using, for instance, the wooden crates that are not supposed to be used. According to the WHO, there are a lot of items, a lot of things that come into play, and those result in this high food loss average. And then this all obviously impacts the country's food security, because you're already really a growing population. We're growing really fast, and we can't keep up with feeding all these people if we lose half of what we grow. So where our platform comes to play is that we shorten this value chain. So instead of the value chain taking up to 24 hours or even 48 hours, our chain takes 8 hours. So we're able to work with the producers, transport their items to our facilities in refrigerated vehicles. Our facilities are completely refrigerated. So even the ramps, the pack houses, the loading dock, all those are refrigerated. And then distributing it to our customers. So that has enabled us to have a food loss average of 5%.
Wow, that was some good to know information, because I didn't know that around 45. I mean, first of all, I didn't know that there is a difference between food waste and food loss. So that's some new information to me. And you mentioned that around 45% of food is lost before even reaching the cold storage. Is that right?
Before reaching retailers.
Oh, okay. Before reaching retailers. Okay. Which is like half of the producers absolutely lost, right? That's a massive number. Okay, so I think somewhere you've mentioned that, you know, if in order to address this problem, blockchain can be used as a technology to sort of address this issue. Because I'm a huge proponent of blockchain technology and have been working on a couple of projects on blockchain technology. And I have mostly seen its application in DeFi or sort of finance sector. But then how do you think it can be applied in agriculture sector?
Sure. So I think it has a huge role to play here. Food traceability, mainly. So you as a consumer have the right to know what you're eating. You have the right to know how this has been grown and what has been sprayed on it. So a lot of items here in Egypt, and I'm sure in other similar countries, claim that they're organic, even though actually they're not organic. They have a lot of pesticides sprayed on them that are not that do not adhere to organic practices. So with blockchain, you're going to have more security and more ability to really make sure that what you're eating is what you intend on eating. That's where a blockchain comes into play. And this is already, it's starting being used in Europe and US. And now, you know, it's our time to bring it here to Egypt and the region.
No, absolutely. I believe blockchain, because this is, I mean, I won't say that this is a new technology. The technology is around 20, 30 years old, but then now we're getting to see the application, be it Web3 or be it DeFi, like transforming the whole finance sector. So yeah, I think the applications can be far more reaching, and glad that you mentioned that. I just want to talk about like the role of women, and first of all, your journey as a women entrepreneur, because coming from Egypt or Middle East region, that is one of the, like, you know, because I also know that in India, which is a highly patriarchal society, and the journey of women entrepreneurs to, first of all, get into the system is quite hard. So I want to talk a little bit about that. So what were the most significant barriers that you face as a women entrepreneur?
Sure. So of course, being an entrepreneur is hard. And then adding on top of that, being a female entrepreneur makes it just that much harder. And then adding on that, a female entrepreneur in agriculture just takes you onto a third level. Those are all issues that we have faced just in general in Egypt. And I've seen it from, you know, different classes, from different profiles. I've seen it from some of our customers, some of our producers that are just not used to speaking to a woman in a professional manner or making a deal with a woman. And so that took a lot of resistance in the beginning. And I remember when I was doing this, something that really stuck with me when I was doing our market research. So I went down in the street and I was just talking to about it.
Oh, that was really some good information that you just shared with us, Farah. So now I want to talk about your journey as a women entrepreneur. And what are the most significant barriers that you have faced as a women entrepreneur so far?
Sure. So like I was saying, Sarab, being an entrepreneur in Egypt is really, you know, being an entrepreneur anywhere is challenging. Being an entrepreneur in Egypt is challenging just as much. And adding on top of that, being a female entrepreneur and then being a female entrepreneur in agriculture. So it's just the three pillars really make it extremely, you know, just hard overall. And I've seen these challenges when I come to speak to customers or producers or even investors. And they're not usually openly discussed. However, you can always realize it in the subconscious of how they would address you and how they address a male counterpart. There's actually a story that comes to mind when I was first starting FreshSource with when Omar and I were first starting. We were collecting some primary research. We were just going down, connecting with some of our potential customers, asking them some questions. After I had finished with one of the customers, he looked at me and he's like, "What? I just want to ask you, what's wrong?" And I told him, "What do you mean, what's wrong?" He's like, "Why are you doing this?" Like, "No, what do you mean, what am I doing with this?" He's like, do you need money? I'm like, "No, I'm good. I'm just asking you some questions." He's like, "Yes, but why is a girl like you starting a company in agriculture? Why don't you go see, you know, do dresses or makeup or something?" I couldn't believe that he said that. And, you know, honestly, it really hurt my feelings that these men actually, like, just don't think that we, you know, we're smart enough to do anything in such a hard industry. Even though, you know, designers and makeup artists, it's also really, it's a tough job overall. So, and there are many men in those industries as well. So it's just, I didn't get why it was so confusing for them. And another issue as well is what you see with investors. So a lot of investors don't like to invest in female-led companies, even though they don't like to admit it to themselves. But they always, you know, come up with something, oh, they're not as aggressive. They're not as dedicated. And usually they end up going for a male-led company. And so we're really, you know, lucky with our investors that they do believe in us, regardless of being a girl or a guy. They believe in our vision, they believe in our mission, and they believe that we have the capabilities of getting to where we want to. So just like to give a piece of advice to any girl, you know, you don't have to stick to society's roles for you if that's what you want. And you really have to be assertive and dominant in order to prove yourself, because it is a very tough ecosystem to be in. And we need to go over and beyond to just appear like a normal, you know?
It's so amazing that, you know, this theme keeps coming up again and again, that men are so intimidated whenever they see any women entering their space. And as you rightly mentioned, in fact, I wanted to, because I was going through one of your interviews and where you mentioned, and I quote, that most of the men don't understand why a woman would enter the agriculture field. And yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. So I'm glad that you mentioned. And I think it's a wonderful job that you're doing by challenging these stereotypes, right? And then when they see a woman entering the sector, or not just the sector, by working at crossroads with farmers and you know, going out for field study. So it's a remarkable thing that you're doing, and then you're just setting the and I'm so glad that you're leading it, leading this thing from the front. So now, talking about that, like continuing, I mean, that's a good segue to talk about the workforce, right? You've also talked about the women representation in the workforce, right? And you mentioned that without this diversity, companies are missing out on so much. So what needs to change according to you, and what did you mean by that?
Sure. So in terms of diversity for startups, or do you mean diversity in the corporate?
No, I was actually just going through one of your interviews, and this is where you mentioned that without this diversity, companies are missing out on so much, or it can be taken in startup context or agriculture. So when, of course, I mean, it is. I mean, there's no debate about it that, you know, we need more diversity. But what, according to you, you know, can women add to the overall discussion?
Sure. So first, it's been proven, you know, loads of research companies with more females on their management and as well their board of directors actually perform better than all male or less female companies. So that's perform better as in more sales. And so that's, you know, should speak for itself. Obviously, and this is something that I learned really well in PNG, where if your main target, so they were targeting mainly females. So that's why loads of, you know, we had around 51% of the workforce being female. And that just, you know, the what they would say is always, we need to understand our customer. And in order to understand our customer, we need our customer to be our part of our team. And so having more females on board, they bring you more diversity, they bring you different opinions, different ways of thinking, they open new doors. So definitely that should be done. And then diversity isn't just with gender. So we need men as well. We need different ages, different nationalities. So these are all aspects that really build a high performing. And then in order to achieve that, there's a lot of conscious effort that needs to be done. So it's not just going to happen by coincidence. You need to have an HR, proper HR and recruitment plan in place in order to have equal diversity. And then you need to also make it easier for women to return to the workplace. So for maternity-wise, how long after she's given birth can she return? And what are the services that are going to be offered after that? So will she be able to bring her baby as well? Are there nurseries? So These are all things that need to come into play for corporate. From the investor side, I believe that having there needs to be also more female-led VCs. So once you have more female-led VCs, you actually see the numbers that they tend to increase the investments in females. So that is something that needs to be done. And then for those that don't really like to invest in females, you know, they just need to see the track records of the other women-led startups and to see what is the opportunity that they're missing out on.
No, absolutely. I think you brought a very wonderful point that we need more women VCs also, because, you know, I have also seen that there are startups or there are organizations who are working on women tech, and it's so amazing and so hilarious at the same time that, you know, although the main customer or the main consumer of the products are women, but then it's a company started up and led by all male team, and it's hilarious. How can you understand a product which is aimed particularly at women? So it's fascinating. So I absolutely agree with you, and I absolutely resonate with it that we definitely need more women workforce, not just from the workforce side, but also we need more women VCs who can understand and can empathize with women-led startups. So great. It was such a wonderful conversation we had. I wish we had more time, but I think we are closing in. Is there anything that you would like to ask from our audience, or is there anything that you would like to mention? That I think we have covered most of the ground, but is there anything that you would like to discuss more about?
No, I like to tell anyone who's thinking about starting a company that one of the most important aspects of the success of a startup, in my opinion, is your co-founding team. So I really urge everyone to really be careful with who they partner up with. I've seen a lot of startups that have failed, even though they were making great sales, great numbers, had good investors, because of the co-founding team not working well together. And so I'm lucky, touch wood, you know, that I have my brother, my biggest supporter, to be my partner throughout this journey. And if I didn't have him, I don't think I would have been able to find another co-founder. So if anyone is considering starting, you need to make sure that you trust your co-founder, you trust their ability. So it has to be someone that you think is smarter than you. You know, if you're fighting now before even starting the company, things are going to get a lot worse. It's like a marriage, you know. So you really have to take care of this part.
Yeah, absolutely. I've mentioned in previous podcasts also, you know, you need to spend more time while choosing a partner or getting, like, you know, if you're going to get married, you need to research more about the co-founder than your own partner. So yeah, it's a wonderful thing that you've just mentioned. So great. Thank you so much for your time, Farah, and thank you for doing the amazing work. You're definitely a hero, and thank you so much for giving us your time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
So that's a wrap for this episode, guys. We hope you enjoyed learning about Ashira's work and how she's using technology to create impact. Don't forget to follow us on our social to stay updated on our new episodes and similar inspiring stories. If you liked what you heard, then please help others to find the show by leaving a 5-star rating or a review wherever you get your podcast. Your support means a world to us and helps us in bringing the success stories of these kick-ass women changemakers, especially to you. So, thank you so much for listening in, and we will see you next time on Tech Shares for Good. Peace out.